countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Ah, and this is our last show of the year, being Saturday, the 28th of December, in the glorious future year 2024. What do I have to talk with you about today? Well, I could, of course, mention the ongoing Russian war against Ukraine and human decency in general, from what one can tell. That, as you may have heard, there was an Azerbaijan Airlines flight, headed from Azerbaijan, obviously, to the Chechen capital Grozny, Chechnya being a restive region of Russia in the Caucasus, which was apparently shot down by Russian air defenses. And I found this story very interesting for a reason which is really only peripherally related to what happened. Because, you see, I'm reminded that the Korean Airlines Flight 007 disaster of 1983, in which a Korean flight strayed off its proper course and flew into Russian Soviet restricted airspace and was shot down by Soviet air defenses in the belief that it was something other than a commercial airliner, was one of the reasons why GPS, satellite navigation, the global positioning system, was made available beyond military use, because it would serve as a useful check on navigation. Well, today, it's become the primary method of navigation for many, many different purposes, which has had this result, namely that the Russians have been jamming satellite navigation signals. It says GPS in the article. I'm not clear on whether Azerbaijan Airlines would use U.S.-provided GPS or the Russian-provided GLONASS system. But either way, the Russians have been jamming the frequencies that are used for satellite navigation in areas where the Ukrainians may be sending unmanned air vehicles, drones in common language, to carry out attacks. And it appears that this Azerbaijan Airlines flight was caught unawares by GPS or other satellite navigation jamming or spoofing, which caused the pilot to deviate from his planned course into an area where the Russians were shooting at everything that flew over. And I feel somehow that this is an interesting phenomenon, that the solution to a problem becomes the problem itself. That's not how, of course, the Hegelian dialectical and its red-headed stepchild Marxist dialectical materialism is supposed to work, but I suspect it's closer to how things actually do happen than either of those idealized philosophical systems. Rolian Com says, how does Publius know so much? To which, of course, the answer is, I am a compulsive reader. I come from a long line of compulsive readers. My mother and her sisters used to fight over the cereal box when they were eating breakfast, just because everyone wanted to read the text printed on the back of the box. Even though, undoubtedly, they'd read it a dozen times before. They had to have something to read. So yes, I'm a compulsive reader, and I retain a certain amount of what I read. But, anyhow, so that was interesting. Tragic, but interesting. Now, not quite so tragic, although still extremely concerning. I suppose you may have heard about the Yipeng 3, which was a Chinese owned and flagged bulk carrier vessel, which loaded up with fertilizer at St. Petersburg, and then seems to have cut several communications cables in the Baltic between Europe and mainland Europe and Scandinavia, either by anchor dragging or by doing something else, and then was essentially impounded in the Kattegat, the strait between Sweden and Denmark, for about a month, and then proceeded on its way after being searched by naval authorities from Scandinavian countries who generally thought that there was something going on that was attributable to Russian military activity. Interestingly, before they were able to board and search it, a Russian, what's referred to as a rescue tug, but a Russian government-owned vessel, which had turned off its automatic identification system transponder to make it more difficult to track, passed close by this ship at a very low speed, may have stopped and dropped someone off, picked someone up, even potentially removed evidence. Unclear. Anyway, that ship then went on its way after being searched, went on its way to Port Said, and nothing in particular has been done. Well, a Cook Islands flagship on Christmas Day, on the 25th, a Cook Islands flagship, an oil tanker carrying a load of oil from St. Petersburg for export customers, appears to have, by a similar means, whether that be anchor dragging or some more deliberate form of sabotage, cut not only several data cables, but also the Estlink 2 underwater high-voltage DC cable, 650-megawatt power cable, between Finland and Estonia. That's a much bigger deal. Kamo cables. Firstly, there are a number of backups. Secondly, the operators are able, in most cases, to relay them or repair them in relatively short period of time. Power cables are another story entirely. There generally are not very many of them, and the authorities in Finland and Estonia are expecting that it will take months to repair the Estlink 2 link, which is going to severely affect the performance of the Baltic power pool. So, as you may be aware, there are some underwater high-voltage transmission lines for electricity, which are used to move power back and forth. Now, on the Sweden-Denmark-Norway side of the Baltic, a particular thing, of course, is that Norwegian hydropower helps to hold up the electrical infrastructure in Denmark and North Germany, particularly where, as I've mentioned many times before, the Danes and Germans and Dutch have installed lots of wind machines, and they sell electricity into the Nordic power pool when there's a lot of wind generation, and the price in the Nordic power pool is very low, and the Norwegians simply stop their hydro generators, because of course those can be switched on and off very easily and rapidly, and buy the cheap power. And then when power prices rise again, the Norwegians open the valves on their hydro plants and sell power into the Nordic power pool, which is a really good deal for Norway. Not quite as good of a deal for Denmark, Netherlands, or Germany, but hey, they want to pay for it. Well, there's also links between, of course, Sweden and Finland, which are partly on land in the far north and partly in the Gulf of Bothnia. And then there are links between Finland and Estonia, basically on the eastern end of the Baltic, which sort of closes the loop. If you imagine the loop being closed by east-west connectors running across the north of the Gulf of Bothnia and then running along the south edge of the Baltic, and then these underwater links are the north-south links at the east and west ends. Anyway, so it forms a loop. Well, now the carrying capacity at the east end of that loop is severely restricted, which limits power flows basically between, not only between Finland and Estonia, but around the Baltic loop in general. And that is going to potentially make a, you know, if the weather is particularly bad, for instance, or if power plants have unexpected shutdowns, which can happen, that's going to be a serious problem, potentially, in the energy an economy, let's call it the energy economy, of Northern Europe. So, I suppose what I want to say here is that, of course, as is well known by now, many countries are building their vision for a future energy economy on, firstly, electrification of everything that can possibly be electrified, after basically trying to do the opposite for about half a century. And secondly, supply of that electricity primarily from sources such as wind and solar, which come when and where they feel like it, not when and where they when and where you want them. And then these plans for energy supply are contingent on very large-scale transfers, real-time transfers of electric power from one end of a continent to another, and also across bodies of water. And so we should always be reminded that transmission lines, long transmission lines, are vulnerable. They are vulnerable to deliberate sabotage, as in this case, but they're also vulnerable to accidents. You know, it's been almost 25 years now since blackouts in California, which were partly due to the fact that California, not generating enough electricity for its own use, was drawing electricity from as far away as Wyoming, and the long-distance power lines, which were transferring more power for longer periods, right, higher duty cycles than had ever been anticipated when they were designed and installed, and in unusually hot summer weather, the transmission lines actually sagged, because of course at higher temperatures the wire stretches, the transmission lines sagged enough to set fire to trees, and then this knocked out these transmission lines and interrupted the supply of electric power to California. So that happened a quarter of a century ago now. So that is something which is very much to be kept in mind, that any of these all-renewables policies, which relies on these very large transfers of power, well, they are inherently vulnerable, far more vulnerable to disruption than a power system which has most of the generation concentrated near the major concentrated loads, in other words, the big cities. And I know that I keep harping on the idea that this is an advantage of nuclear power. It doesn't have to be situated near the fuel source, as in the case of a lignite-burning power plant. Lignite having a low fuel value, you can't ship it much of anywhere, so it has to be burned on site and the power sent elsewhere. It doesn't have to be located where any kind of energy resource is, whether that be wind or sun. The fuel, the energy resource for the power plant, is so small in quantity that you can carry all that you would need for your entire life in your pockets without noticing the weight much. Now, of course, when we talk about energy supply, we also have to talk about energy demand. Where is it going? And a great use of electricity, perhaps not the major user of energy, but one of the faster growing and higher profile uses of electricity in the past quarter century or so, certainly, has been data centers, computing in general. And everybody in the field of computing pretty much agrees that although the physical hardware is made to be as energy efficient as possible, the computing that's done on it is not, that processor cycles, memory occupancy, and so forth are essentially treated as free, and instead of making any attempt to optimize programs, instead these, for example, frameworks, as they call them, are used, which are extraordinarily inefficient on both the server side and the client side, but they make someone somewhere happy. Another thing that is often observed is the collection of vast quantities of information in so-called business intelligence schemes, which are meant to help the people who make decisions for businesses make better decisions. Whether they work or not is very unclear. And, of course, the Chaos Computer Club's conference is going on right now, 38C3 in Germany. And so last year, the highlight of 37C3 was the discovery that a company had sold a bunch of train sets to a Polish operator, which would disable themselves mysteriously if they were kept in the maintenance depot of anybody other than the original vendor for any length of time. And, in fact, would disable themselves randomly to require you to send them back to the original vendor for maintenance. Now, this is pretty goddamn hideous, if you ask me. And the hackers, computer programmers, who turned up this, finally figured out what was going on, and disclosed it to the world at 37C3, are now being sued very heavily by the company that manufactured the train sets. I'm kind of hoping that the Polish government puts them out of business, actually. Now, at 38C3, what was the big bombshell on the first day? Well, somebody, one of the, of course, big vendors of computing services and data storage is Amazon. And somebody trolling the internet for unsecured AWS buckets, as they're known, data stores provided by Amazon Web Services, which are pretty much publicly accessible even when they're not actually meant to be. Well, somebody discovered that all of the cars sold by Volkswagen in recent years have been reporting their position and speed at frequent intervals to centralized data collection at Volkswagen, and so all of these reports have gone into an AWS bucket. And if you happen to download the contents of this bucket, why, you can then identify for millions of, in most cases, fairly expensive cars, cars owned by fairly well-to-do people, where they start, where they originate from, where they go to, how long they spend in transit, how long they spend at each given place, what time of day they're not likely to be home, so you can most easily break into their house. Places that they're going that you're surprised by, that you could maybe blackmail them about, and so on. As I've repeatedly said, if you collect information, right, The phrase data breach really doesn't explain what's going on here. If you collect information, it's going to be compromised. Now, whether or not that happens sooner or later will depend on two things. One of them is random chance, and the other is how much care you took with the information. In this particular case, the amount of care taken with the information was zero. And so the random chance parameter is the more important one. But here's the thing. The corollary of this is, if you don't want data to be exposed to people who are not you, whatever business you think you may have collecting the data, they certainly don't, and may use it for nefarious purposes. The only recourse you have, the only solution available to you, is simply not to collect the data. I want to emphasize that. The only way to preserve information security is simply not to collect data. But, of course, people want to collect data because collecting data, they refer to it as the new oil. Surely in all this data, there's something that's valuable. And, of course, one of the things people want lots of data for is to train, quote, AI, large language models and other generative systems. What do they think they're going to achieve with them? Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, Microsoft has just gone over to, it's bundled its so-called Copilot, which as far as I can tell is a feature that nobody wants, in its Office 365 suite. Remember, you used to buy Microsoft Office, now you rent it, and they can change what's in it and how it works and what they charge you for it at any time. So they've now bundled Copilot with Office 365, and they are charging you for it. Presumably on the idea that although no one wants this, and certainly no one wants to pay for it, no one wants it enough to pay for it, if they charge you for it, you'll start using it because you're already paying for it. And of course, there are many business managers, people who don't really understand anything technical, who want AI incorporated in everything, and so they'll think, oh, well, this is good. And that makes Microsoft's share price go up, presumably. Now, this is where things get interesting. I think. Not just because data centers and, by extension, AI, big users of energy. But, so in the Wall Street Journal recently, there was a little article about technology is changing how people buy things, which is a pretty generic statement, right? That's always going to be true. But one of the things that they talked about in the article was how people are starting to not trust the World Wide Web. They're starting to realize, 15 years or more after I started to realize it, that product reviews online are mostly not created by people who have your best interest in heart. Many of them are fakes or some kind of scam. I mean, you know, blog comments back in 2005 were full of this stuff, so I don't know why it's any surprise to anyone now. And that many e-commerce sites aren't actually for real. You can click on a button and send them your payment information and never actually get anything. And even worse, it's possible that instead of just taking your money and sending you nothing, you may get sucked into one of these bizarre identity theft scam scenarios. So, all this gets very complicated, right? But one of the things they said was that people are becoming more and more dependent on sort of quasi-personal interactions. And the phrase that, you know, recommendations from, you can see it's a real person because you can see them and they're talking to you and even responding to you. In other words, streamers on Twitch, people making videos on TikTok, people posting photos and videos on Instagram, and the phrase that came up in this article was social media influencer management agencies, which I suppose is halfway between an advertising agency and a talent agency. So yeah. If you think about it, things like Instagram and TikTok and Twitch and YouTube in its current state, all of which their promise is, right, that you can interact with your friends, you can show off your creativity to people you know, and they can see what you're doing and get back to you, and maybe you'll find some online friends, that kind of thing. That's the pitch, right? It's not what these things are actually for. We are seeing it perhaps most blatantly with things like the TikTok shopping, where TikTok is actually incorporating product links, right? But the whole thing being that these are primarily not ways for bottom-up user-generated content, which has always been the promise that's even sort of implicitly written into certain legislation, at least in the United States, which provides a safe harbor provision for user-generated content on platforms. So the idea is that these are bottom-up, you know, it's the people at large communicating with each other, and it's not really. It's a screen. It's a kind of false front, where the people who get the most interaction, the people you are most likely to see videos from or photographs from, the people you are most likely, outside of perhaps your three or four closest friends, to have anything to do with on these platforms, are simply mouthpieces for the same old players, whether those be, you know, IBM and Dow Chemical and General Electric. Except now, instead of having one Ronald Reagan, right, on the television advertising for GE, they've got 10,000 different Ronald Reagans. So yeah, if you want to know what AI is for, my guess is that it has something to do with 10,000 Ronald Reagans. In other words, that what generative AI is most wanted for is increasing the visibility and throughput of these content creator merchandising and marketing activities. But I don't want to talk about that anymore. I want to talk about something else much more interesting, which is that I went to get my flu shot a couple of weeks back. Now you're saying, what are you talking about? Why is this more interesting? And I didn't say at the time I'm going to get my flu shot before RFK Jr. makes it illegal. But I've been thinking a lot about the outbreaks of everything from influenza to measles to rabies as a result of people being against vaccination. And of course, this made me think about the Iditarod. It made me think, you know, they made Don Bluth, made a children's animated movie about Balto a few years back. I don't know, 20, 30 years back, maybe? And I wonder if we can get the revival in popularity, right? Because the story of one of the world's great races, the race, the overland race to Nome in 1925 to bring the diphtheria serum to treat and inoculate against the epidemic outbreak of diphtheria in the Nome area is really one of those great stories. And it made me think a little bit about a phrase coined by Abraham Lincoln, which if you're an American, you've heard many times, the last full measure of devotion, which Abraham Lincoln used to talk about the soldiers who died in the Battle of Gettysburg. It's one of the phrases in his very famous Gettysburg Address, which is one of those American-isms. Every American, it doesn't know it by heart, but can say, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent, etc. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows the ending phrase about government by the people, for the people, and of the people shall not perish from the earth, right? So, last full measure of devotion. A very common American phrase, and I thought, you know, the greatest example of last full measure of devotion, and let's see if I can talk about this without actually completely choking up, which is hard. During that great race to Nome in 1925, it was reported at least one and possibly more of the dog teams. The lead dog dropped dead of exhaustion, and the musher strapped himself into the traces to lead the team. If that doesn't count as the last full measure of devotion, I don't know what does. So go out there and get your vaccines, okay, kids? Get your vaccinations. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnOnRadio.net, a show in which I talk about vaccinations as being the second most important biological technology after agriculture. Every Saturday at 19 UTC on anonradio.net just before the dubious...